Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
From WNYC in New York, this is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer. Time magazine called Angelique Kidjo Africa's premier diva. Nobel Peace Prize winner Desmond Tutu says she has used her fame wonderfully to promote her ideals, which are universal ideals. The late Nelson Mandela and President Bill Clinton have also praised her blend of music and activism. So what the heck is she doing hanging around with us? Well, as it turns out, singing songs and telling tales. We'll hear from the Benin-born, New York-based singer and songwriter in just a bit. And a little legal activism pits a famous rapper against the duo that had the biggest pop hit in 2011. Yeah.
Woo! Let's go.
Party Rock is in the house tonight. Everybody just have a good time.
Yes, Party Rock Anthem by LMFAO was the number one song on Billboard's pop song chart for 2011. Apparently, we as a country experienced one big brain cramp that year. Actually, I don't mind the song. It's fun and silly. Even the lawsuit from rapper Rick Ross, who's suing over the use of a key phrase in the song, is kind of silly.
Every day I'm shuffling.
Or at least that's how it seems to me, but we'll get the details later. So, anyway, LMFAO goes to number one on the Hot 100 in 2011. Two young gentlemen of color at the top of the charts. Nothing unusual there. Then, they started 2012 back on top of the Hot 100 with their follow-up single, Sexy and I Know It. But you know what's weird? There was no LMFAO on top of the Hot 100 in 2013. No Jay-Z at the top either. No Drake, no Beyoncé, no Kanye. In fact, not a single black artist topped the Hot 100 last year. Not one. I couldn't believe it when I read it, but it's right here in Chris Melanfi's article, which you can see at soundcheck.org. Chris is our pop chart guru, and he's here to see if we can make some sense of this. And joining us as well is writer Kelly Goff. She is an author, political analyst, and correspondent for The Daily Beast and The Root. To both of you, welcome back to Soundcheck.
Thanks, John.
Happy New Year.
So, Chris, is this a fluke, or is there something more nefarious at work here?
Well, I would call it a fluke, but it's a fluke with a nefarious undertone, if I may use your phrase. There's definitely been less crossover to the Hot 100, which, of course, we all call it the big pop chart, right?
I mean, right. So this is where our top 40 comes from.
Right. When people say the top 40, they're talking about the top 40 positions of this chart, right? And this is unprecedented since the Hot 100 was invented in 1958. We've never had a year where not a single African-American artist has topped the Hot 100, I want to state this right, as a lead act. And as if rubbing salt in the wound, it wasn't as if there were absolutely no black people atop the Hot 100 this year. It's just that the few that were in supporting roles. On Blurred Lines, the hit summer
jam. So Pharrell
jam.
Williams helping
Pharrell
Robin
Williams
Thicke.
And T.I. the rapper.
Okay.
On, the current number one hit, The Monster by Eminem. We've got Rihanna supporting that. So there have been a handful. But this is unprecedented that not a single black artist tops the Hot 100.
Kelly, I mean, when I read this in Chris's art, I mean, it was sort of flabbergasting when you think of just how important albums by black artists were in the past year, to think that not a single number one single was there.
Well, and what was funny is I actually had to do a double take because I was like, that can't be right. That was my first instinct. I was like, no, that can't be right. He was definitely right, though. And I do think it's interesting. And it's sort of, I mean, I'm being semi-melodramatic here, so bear with me. But I do think there's something a little, when he said there is something, a nefarious undercurrent, a little bit of what's going on, I feel like, in culture is it almost reminds me, not that I was around then, but the 50s and 60s where you had a lot of music that was being co-opted by white artists and popularized
by
them. But it was coming from black artists who were kind of getting the short end of the stick. And that's a little bit, I feel like, of what's going on here, is it's much easier to sell a Macklemore, a Ryan Lewis, an Eminem, a Justin Timberlake to mainstream audiences than it is to sell a Jay-Z, even Jay-Z. And you know, I've had my issues with Jay-Z, as we've discussed on this show, but I'm talking about when you look at the top artists producing in the areas of R&B, of hip hop, it is still, I think, a preferred feeling in the in mainstream pop culture. If we can find an attractive white act to do it, why not? It's easier to sell.
But the idea that, you know, I mean, this is the first time in the history of these charts that we've taken this kind of step backwards, you know, in terms of diversity, just seems astonishing. How does this compare, Chris, to take us 10 years ago?
Right. And that's an illustrative comparison because literally every song that went to number one on the Hot 100 in the year 2004 was by a person of color. Every last one. Wow. So including that year's American Idol winner, Fantasia, who also had a number one hit, and even she was African-American.
So at this time, 10 years ago, the number one song in the nation was this one from the Atlanta band Outkast.
One, two, three, My baby don't mess around because she loves me so, and this I know for sure.
From Outkast was the number one song on the Billboard Hot 100 10 years ago, but in all of 2013, not a single African-American artist had the number one hit. First time that that has happened in the history of the chart, as Chris Melanfi was telling us. And again, you can read his article on the Billboard charts of 2013 on our website, soundcheck.org. Kelly Goff of the Daily Beast and The Root also with me here in the Soundcheck studio. So both of you seem to think there is something here other than a fluke.
It should be remembered that, of course, Billboard's charts exist not just for us as fans. They exist for the industry.
Right.
And as the industry notices what's popular, they then move in a direction to generate more of what's popular, right?
I mean, but this is... I mean, Jay-Z, Kanye, Beyonce, these were hugely popular records.
Totally. But then the world of the Hot 100 is a world of singles. And basically what's happened is whether it's radio, whether it's iTunes, there's now a lot of data feeding into the Hot 100. And you're not seeing in these last few years that feedback loop that we had 10 years ago. It should be noted that the charts we just discussed of 10 years ago when Outkast was number one, there was no – iTunes existed, but iTunes was not a factor in the charts yet because it was brand new. There was no YouTube, literally didn't exist. And so this great feedback loop that we used to have where we had crossover, a common term in the industry, from the R&B charts to the pop charts, it's kind of gotten swamped. There's more data going into the Hot 100 now than ever before. Yes, black artists still sell albums. Jay-Z had a number one album this year with Magna Carta Holy Grail. I could list several. Drake had a number one album. ASAP Rocky had a number one album. Of course, famously, Beyonce just had a massive number one album at the end of the year. But the singles charts are kind of another animal. These are the songs we live with for months on end. And it doesn't seem that with all this data flowing into the Hot 100 that we're getting that feedback loop that leads to crossover.
Mm. And so here's what I was going to say. I think part of what's going on in these charts is there was a time when the person who's buying an R&B record or the person who's determining how they feel about a song is not just determining based on how the song sounds, but whether or not that person's image speaks to them.
Right.
And I think a lot of that has kind of dissipated in the fact that now I walk into a store, I hear something playing over the intercom, I'm like, that's an interesting song. And then I go home, I'm not watching an MTV video.
Right.
I'm simply going like to iTunes and I'm Googling the lyrics and then I'm hitting iTunes, and that's what we're losing. And so there's some people who think that's great. That speaks to American moving forward.
I was just going
to
say, isn't that a good thing?
And then there are people who think, you know what? If someone's talking about how downtrodden they are and that's what they're rapping about, I'd like to not know that the person is actually a white guy who went to a prep school.
Mm.
Now, I don't know if there's a right or wrong. I'm just saying that I think that that's where part of the debate is.
Right. Exactly. Well, this is a debate that's as old as Elvis Presley.
Right. Exactly. Yes. Which is why I said it kind of reminds me of, you know, back in the 50s.
All right. 50s. So You've both mentioned Macklemore and Ryan Lewis. I mean, Thrift Shop was a number one song.
Number one song of 2013, according to Billboard's Hot 100.
And this was one of those instances, Chris, where there was an artist of color involved in a supporting role, right?
Right. Wans, the rapper who does that line, I'm going to pop some tags, in the chorus. Yes. So he's a supporting artist. There's actually an African-American supporting artist on both of their number one hits this year. They had a second one called Can't Hold Us, which had supporting singing from Ray Dalton. So, yes.
But perhaps more to the point, this song, Thrift Shop by Macklemore and Ryan Lewis, was not just number one on the Hot 100, it was number one on the R&B chart as well. Passing up on those moccasins, someone else has been walking in by me and grungy f***ing men. I am stunting and flossing and saving my money and I'm hella happy that's a bargain. I'ma take your grandpa style, I'ma take your grandpa style. No, for real, ask your grandpa, can I have his hand-me-down? Your lord jumpsuit and some house slippers, Dookie Brown leather jacket that I found, dig it. They had a broken keyboard, I bought a broken keyboard. I bought a ski blanket, then I bought a kneeboard. Hello, hello, my ace man, my Miller. John Wayne ain't got nothing on my fringe game, hell no. I could take some pro wings, make them cool, sell those. The sneakerheads would be like, he got the Velcro.
I'm gonna pop some tags, only got $20 in my pocket. I'm hunting, looking for a come up. This is being awesome. Ow. I'm gonna pop some tags, only got $20 in my pocket.
A little bit of Thrift Shop, number one song from Macklemore and Ryan Lewis from last year. And Kelly, to your point, when I first heard this song, I didn't know these guys were white. And when I found out, I have to confess, I felt a little, oh.
He said it, I didn't, everyone.
just a little part of me went, oh. But you know, again, this was not just number one on the Hot 100, but to your point, Kelly, this was number one on the R&B charts.
Right.
Now, is that really where the nub of this problem is? What has happened to the R&B / hip-hop charts and what that sort of means to a community?
And that's what I think this is one of those debates where I think you ask 100 people, you might get 100 answers or at least, you know, 50 different answers on both sides.
I am going to throw it out to you, Soundcheck listeners. What do you think about this? Leave your comments on our website, soundcheck.org. Not a single artist of color had a number one single last year, despite some mammoth successful records by some of these
artists.
And
let me just say, too, that, you know, there's an argument to be made that this debate is not just about color. It's not race specific, because how long have we been having this debate in hip hop about whether or not the guy who's rapping about slinging rock on the street and actually had a middle class two parent upbringing should really be perpetuating that image?
Totally.
So that's part of it. But I do think that as we increasingly sort of move into this, you know, it's so-called post-racial America, which a lot of us don't believe they're in such a thing, about what happens to our art. Because it's not going to be just about music. We're going to have to see this happening in movies in terms of who gets to tell what stories and who can define an authentic experience. And so, you know, are we ready to say that absolutely no white person can touch hip hop? Well, that's ridiculous. But on the other hand, are we ready to say that white people should define hip hop in its entirety, which is a little bit what's happening with these charts? And I think that that's a fair, you know, thing to question.
Right. Now, Chris, you point out that the R&B charts, 44 out of the 52 weeks of last year, white artists on the top of the R&B chart.
Right.
Has something happened to that chart?
Yes.
Okay, what?
There was a technical change there, but this technical change is really vital. So up until the end of 2012, fall of 2012, the R&B chart did not have any digital sales baked into it. It had a formula that had existed since the 60s, which blended airplay at black-oriented radio stations, R&B radio stations, hip-hop radio stations, mixed with sales of singles, 45s and singles and what have you, at what were called core R&B stores. That's code for stores that predominantly serve a black audience or an R&B consumer base, right? And that system worked pretty darn well for 40 years. Mm-hmm. But it started to fall apart 10 years ago as we moved into the digital era, simply because all record stores, black-owned or not, were starting to collapse, right? So basically what started to happen was the R&B chart was essentially an airplay chart. There was no sales component at all. At the end of 2012, Billboard said, we're going to rectify this situation. And just like we do on the Hot 100, they did it back in 2005 on the Hot 100. We're going to bake in digital sales in the R&B chart. Okay, on the surface, sounds like a great move. The problem is, What are we measuring now? Are we measuring what an R&B core audience listens to? Or are we listening to any music that could broadly be defined as R&B or hip hop? And this is how you end up with 44 out of 52 weeks white people topping the R&B chart. Is Justin Timberlake an R&B artist? Well, he's certainly enjoyed by certain factions of the R&B audience. It's unfair to exclude him from the chart. But if you're going to pile in all the digital sales of Justin Timberlake songs, he's going to go to number one. Yeah. Eminem, Macklemore. Macklemore was number one for weeks on end. Robin Thicke. These guys were all number one on the R&B chart.
What about Bruno Mars?
Bruno Mars, interestingly, is not on the R&B chart, I think largely because he's not considered a core R&B artist, so Billboard just doesn't count his digital sales for that chart. But and I see Kelly throwing up her hands, and she's exactly right to be throwing up her hands. Where do you draw this line? And you didn't – here's the thing.
And who draws that line?
Billboard effectively does in consultation with the industry. So this is the part that starts to seem a little nefarious, right? What made the old system great was that you didn't have to make these judgment calls. Billboard didn't have to decide what qualified. Hall & Oates, who we were talking about earlier, they're being inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. They had a number one, not just pop, but R&B record in 1982. I Can't Go For That topped the R&B chart in 1982. Great record. And it topped it because actual R&B stations were playing it. And if you went to a black-oriented record store, people were buying it. You didn't have to make a judgment call. Are these guys white enough? Right. Are they black enough? Are they singing R&B? That made the system transparent. Nobody questioned it. Now, if you're piling in all the digital sales onto the R&B chart, I guess we have to allow Justin Timberlake. The problem is Justin Timberlake is selling 3 million digital singles, and, you know, Miguel is selling a tenth of that.
And by the way, most of them aren't going to R&B fans.
Right.
So this is you know,
that's
the full circle point.
Exactly.
All right. Well, I'm going to play a little bit of that Hall & Oates song because it does two things. It sort of gets to you've mentioned it. It's in the context of this conversation, but it also allows us to pivot to a similar but different question, which is the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame inductees for this year. Hall & Oates, number one single back in the early 80s on both the Hot 100 and R&B charts. In early 1982, that was the number one single on both the Hot 100 and the R&B charts. Hall & Oates with I Can't Go For That. And back in those days, to have a white band topping the R&B charts was unusual.
It was.
Last year, 44 out of the 52 weeks white artists topping the R&B charts, partly, as Chris Melanfi has just told us, due to a change in how the chart is created by Billboard magazine. So suddenly, there are decisions to be made rather than simply tabulating and calculating and just saying, here's what you people are buying and here's what you people are listening to. Now, Kelly Goff, also with me here on Soundcheck, when we start talking about the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, with Hall & Oates part of this year's inductees.
As they should be.
Here, here.
I'm a fan on their greatest hits, like a lot of African Americans, by the way.
Mm-hmm. Seriously.
But now we are talking about a relatively small group of people. I think there are 700 eligible voters.
And the nominating committee is super small.
Making choices about who is in and who is out. And for the first time, or the second time, only the second time in its 28-year history, the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame is not inducting a living person of color. Clarence Clemons is being inducted posthumously.
That's part of the E Street Band, for those who don't know. Yeah,
right. The sax player with Bruce Springsteen. So, you know, this seems to me a little more problematic than
or a lot more, depending on how you look at it.
All right, tell me how you look at it.
Well, okay, so there are a couple of things. First of all, I will totally own up to some bias here because I know Nile Rodgers, but before I was friendly with
the mastermind behind Chic.
Behind Chic, who was nominated as someone wrote, I think Chris, this might have been you, that he's officially the Susan Lucci now, which I'm sure everyone's dying to be compared to the Susan Lucci of anything when they're
nominated
for something.
Eight nominations, no inductions.
And no inductions. Which is just a travesty, and it because it's forget how you feel about, you know, disco music, which is how he's most identified. He's co-produced some of the most influential albums in history, not in a year, not in an era, not in a genre, but in history. David Bowie's Let's Dance. Madonna's breakthrough
like
album. I mean, it's literally so how anyone could question whether or not he belongs is mind-boggling to me. But the larger issue I really see here is you know, this kind of goes back to what we were hinting at earlier about the whole, you know, post-racial thing. I think often people pride themselves on being, quote, colorblind. I don't see color. I don't think about it. And often when people use that language, what ends up happening is the color disappears from the equation, from the conversation, from the room. Mm-hmm. And so a lot of minorities, when we hear people say, you know, we just aim for colorblind, whether it's in hiring, whether it's in recruiting, whether it's in nominating, that, you know, that's often a little bit scary because to me, when you say you're going for colorblind, it means, you know, we end up being invisible. I mean, we shouldn't have to not see each other's color. We should be able to see each other's color and not have that be a problem.
Yeah.
And so what I kind of saw in this process is that there were people who were probably saying, we just went with who we like and we didn't think about diversity. Maybe you should have. Because the thing is, it's not like with Nile, it's not the argument of, well, if you worry about color, you don't get the most qualified. He's qualified. Do you know what I mean? And that's what
qualified.
I found so bizarre is that if you'd been thinking more about diversity, you'd say, you know, looking at this list, maybe this should be the year that Nile Rodgers gets it. Not next year, not 2 years from now, not 3 years from now, because he'll eventually get it. But people are saying, you know, it could end up being like, you know, you always see someone at the Oscars who gets the award when they can barely stand up anymore because they got passed over when they were in their prime.
Or like Donna Summer, they never make it at all. Poor Donna was finally inducted after she died last year.
Which is, yeah.
So, I mean, the bizarre thing to me is that you even have to mention the whole diversity thing, that Nile Rodgers just on the merit basis of is it because there is the lingering stench of disco attached to him and the voters tend to be from the old disco sucks generation?
I think that's part of it. I mean, again, as I mentioned just a second ago, Donna Summer was nominated, I believe, 5 times before she finally got in. Not the worst number, but not a great one either. Disco is probably even more divisive than hip-hop, actually, because hip-hop acts started to get inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame with Grandmaster Flash and Run DMC a few years ago, pretty much right when they were eligible. So it wasn't like they made them wait a long time, whereas disco has always been verboten for certain...
But we also know, I mean, there's a racial component to that, too. I mean, I'm sorry, I have to go there.
Oh, here.
You know, Janetta Adams, who's a writer for our site, you know, wrote a beautiful piece for The Root, you know, making the case for these acts that were sort of passed over. But, you know, one of the things that she referenced was the whole disco sucks movement, which was very much entwined with race. It's like it was sort of seen as this, you know, no self-respecting white Midwesterner would ever dare touch this music. And so, and again, I want to be very clear here in these conversations. I don't want your listeners to tweet me angry things and say that he's like, why do you have to make it about race? I don't think this is conscious. What I'm saying is sometimes we're in a better position when we make these conversations conscious, right? Mm. When we say, just think about it. I sort of compare how we should sort of think about, you know, race and gender equity and all of these issues. The Rooney Rule in football, which I can barely follow a football game, but I'm familiar with the Rooney Rule because I write about race, which is when they say, you know, if you're going to hire a new head football coach for your team, just interview. Just think about it. And it forces people to think about it. They don't say who you have to hire. And I kind of think that
And yet, look what has happened. We have seen numerous African-American football coaches.
There you go. So I think about a situation like this where what if someone had actually said, we're not telling you who you have to pick. What we are saying is think about it.
Right.
Think about how this will look. Just think about it. Factor it in.
And in the case of Nile Rodgers, 2013, he had a good year.
I know. I was beating my breast in the piece I wrote for Slate. I mean, if ever there were a year, he put out a 4-year consideration ad for them. He played the best guitar riff on any pop song of the year in
Daft
Get
Punk.
Lucky by Daft Punk. And that, you know, if not this year, when? That was what I asked. When is he going to get inducted? My goodness.
Well, for your consideration, we will play a little bit of Daft Punk's Get Lucky featuring the great Nile Rodgers on guitar. He does belong in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. With me in the soundcheck studio, Chris Malanfi, pop chart columnist and critic for Slate.com and Billboard and Rolling Stone and elsewhere. Kelly Goff, author, political analyst, correspondent for The Root and The Daily Beast. Kelly and Chris, it is a big conversation. We'll invite our listeners to join it online at soundcheck.org, but thanks for getting us started today.
Thank you, John.
Thanks for having us here.
Like the legend of the phoenix, huh. All ends with beginnings. What keeps the planet spinning? The force from the beginning.
Next, from Benin by way of Brooklyn, it's singer Angelique Kidjo returning to our studio with a new album and a new memoir and one very big voice. She'll perform in our studio next. Later, can rapper Rick Ross copyright the phrase, "Every day I'm hustling"? Soundcheck's copycat weighs in. This is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer. If you've ever seen Grammy-winning singer Angelique Kidjo perform live, well, you know she's a powerful, larger-than-life figure on stage. Born in Benin, West Africa, and now living in Brooklyn, New York, she's apparently a dynamo offstage as well, because she's about to release this album, Eve, later this month, and has just put out a memoir called Spirit Rising, all while traveling the developing world as a UNICEF Goodwill Ambassador. With blurbs from Bill Clinton and Bono, and introductory words by Desmond Tutu and Alicia Keys, Spirit Rising recounts her life in music and beyond. She's here with guitarist Dominique James to perform some stripped-down songs from the new record for us. This first one is called Kulumbu. It's Angelique Kidjo, live on Soundcheck. Kulumbu, Kulumbu, yeah, oh yeah, Kulumbu.
Colombo.
That is Angelique Kidjo and a song called Kulumbu, which will be on her new record called Eve, comes out on January 28th, performing with guitarist Dominique James here in the Soundcheck studio. If there's ever a person for whom there aren't enough hours in the day, that's got to be, you've been working on this new record, you've been working on the book, the memoir, you have your Batonga Foundation at work in West Africa. How do you juggle all of that?
Well, I juggle all of that, having in mind one of the phrases that my grandmother used to tell me when I was little. I would tell my grandma, I'm so tired. And she'd go, you tired at your age? You rest when you're 6 feet under. Come on, get up and go work.
So your grandmother basically said, I'll sleep when I'm dead.
Yes, that's what she did. She worked basically till 1 year before she passed away. She was 107 when she passed away, and she never stopped. And to stop her working, it was something else.
So now this gets to the theme of this the new record, Eve, which is about
women
in Africa and their strength and their persistence and perseverance.
I mean, the African women are so beautiful, but most of the time in the media, the image of African people is just poverty, misery, and nothing good come out of Africa. And if you look at music, basically, everybody have something from Africa. We've given the world so much arts, so much music, and every different kind of form of art that exists has been impacted by Africa. And the African women, for me, are my backbone, and are the backbone of that continent. Without the African women, Africa would be in the worst shape that it is right now. And I decided also to call the album Eve because it's the first woman that we know the story of, and it's the little name of my mother too. But the Eve story has been told by men. Once again, we are defined by people that have interest for us to be below them. So the story as it comes out, Eve tempted Adam to eat the apple.
So everything's Eve's fault.
So Adam, did Adam have a brain? Actually, did you have brain to use? Or Eve actually overpowered Adam and put him down on the floor, put her knees on his throat and said, shovel the apple in his mouth and he has to eat it. I mean, it's the same thing that we are defined by other people. When your story is not told by yourself, you always end up being somebody's fool. And so we have been the fool of the people that have been telling the story of Adam from the beginning.
So now this album's dedicated to the spirit of the women of Africa, but it also dovetails nicely with the Batonga Foundation.
Absolutely, because the purpose of Batonga Foundation is to give a secondary and higher education to girls to transform Africa.
We're speaking with Angelique Kidjo, the Benin-born, Brooklyn-based singer and songwriter and goodwill ambassador for UNICEF. Your own story, as recounted in Spirit Rising, your new memoir, the importance of you having access to education in your family. You know, your parents wanted you to go to school. They wanted you to, you know, they wanted you to know about the arts and culture and stuff like that.
Well, my father always used to say, the only wealth I can give you is to send you to school. Because he always said, I don't have enough energy to decide for you. And I don't want to decide for you. I'm your father. I shouldn't be the person that decide who you have to choose as a partner of life or what direction or what you want to do in your life. You have to be in charge of yourself.
That sounds very progressive. I mean, for many parts of the world, but especially
in Africa,
especially for Benin in like the 1960s and 70s.
Till today, it's kind of very conservative society. And my father was really looked at like a weirdo.
Well, again, that's the very progressive thinking from members of the Kijo family there in Benin. Angelique Kijo is with us here in our New York studio as she visits from time to time. A new album coming out on January 28th called Eve, the memoir Spirit Rising, My Life and My Music is just out now. There are many other questions I'd like to ask you about this, but I'll save that for Thursday when we do a little Q&A at the Barnes & Noble at Union Square. That'll be 7 p.m. on Thursday evening. You want to play another song for us from the new record?
Yes, I will play. Awalole, the song that I'm going to play right now, is about the leadership, the future leaders in Africa. And the leaders, the young kid told me the story. We want to be different leaders. If you come 10 to 20 years from now, we will transform Africa because we take lead serving the people, not serving ourselves.
Okay. So that's Awolele?
Awolele, yeah.
Angelique Kijo is the singer and songwriter, and Dominique James is accompanying her on, he'll switch to acoustic guitar for this song, here in the Soundcheck studio. Once again, this song will be on the new CD, Eve, when it comes out on the 28th, but here's a live performance in the Soundcheck studio.
Baba, to perfect me, Kukunio, Awani, to perfect me, Orisha, Awani, Awano lady, egg, baby, Baba, Awano lady, egg, baby, Wani Baba, Awano lady, egg, baby, Baba, Awano lady, egg, baby, Winnie Baba, to perfect me, lady, yo, Awani, to perfect me. Awa, awa na eleri, awa woni ta lo fe so were lopon o. Awa, awa na eleri, awa ta lo fe so were lopon o. Awa, awa na eleri, awa. Yeah. Ani we mero po re wa gbe lo. Baba, awalo lady, egg, baby, wani. Oh, awalo lady, egg, baby, ni baba. Oh, awalo lady, egg, baby, wani, baba. Toba fek be kukunyo, awani. Toba fek be orisha, oh, awani. Awalo lady, egg, baby, ni baba. Awalo lady, egg, baby, wani, baba. Awalo Awalo lady, egg, baby, wani baba. Toba fek be kukunyo, awani. Oh, toba fek be orisha, awani. Awani, awani, awani. Awalo lady, egg, baby, mini baba. Awalo lady, egg, baby, mini baba. Awalo lady, egg, baby, wani baba.
That is Angelique Kijo live on Soundcheck and a song called Awalele which will appear on her next album, Eve, out on January 28th. The memoir, Spirit Rising, is just out. And Angelique and guitarist Dominique James performing for us here on Soundcheck. This next song is an old one called Blewu, originally from the Togolese singer Bella Bello, who was a formative influence on a young Angelique Kidjo. And here she is to sing this song for us live on Soundcheck. Lovely. Angelique Kidjo, live on Soundcheck with Dominique James playing the guitar. Blewu is a song from Bella Bello, who, Angelique, when you were growing up in Benin, she was kind of a star next door in Togo, right?
Absolutely. And for me, seeing her singing was kind of like seeing an angel on earth singing. She has that grace and that smile, angel smile on her face. And for me, she passed away too young. I was 13 years old when she died in a car accident. I think she was 27.
Wow.
And that triggered a song in me. The first song that I have written was after her death.
Let me ask you something about your work with UNICEF as a goodwill ambassador. You write a little bit about this in the book, Spirit Rising, but, you know, through this work, you are spending time with some of the most famous people on our planet, presidents and pop stars and actors and activists. And then you are in some of the most dire and grim places on Earth with, you know, kids and women who have been the real victims of conflicts around the world. And then you have to come home and deal with, you know, what am I making for dinner tonight? You know, the sort of routine worries. And how have you been able to do that?
Well, I think that if I didn't have music, I would have lost my mind a long time ago, because the harm that we are able to put on ourselves and other people is just amazing to me. The creativity in horror that we have is just flabbergasting. Mm. And yet, the victim of those horror are the ones that give us strength to continue. They want to go back home and see a different life for their children. They want them to be different. They want them to go to school, to be part of the process, long-lasting process, peace process.
Right.
And that's what give me the strength when I come back here, to cherish the moment that I come back, to hug my child, to hug my husband, to see my friends. Music helped me gather people around me to replenish myself. But that trip that I took in Chad have impacted my sleep till today.
Hmm. And yet you also write in the book that it's okay to have the routine worries of, you know, that's okay too.
It's okay. We have to. We are normal. We're human beings.
Are you worried about this new Philip Glass piece that he's written for you? Philip Glass has written a piece for Angelique Kidjo and the Luxembourg Philharmonic, who are on the upcoming record on the song Awolele that you performed for
us. Yeah, it's going to be difficult. It is beautiful beyond beautiful because I've been working with Philip for a while now. We've known each other at least for 15 years, and he knows my voice. So he really wrote the song really to fit my voice, and it's a challenge that I'm taking on with a lot of tingle in my body and a lot of joy, a lot of impatience because I want to see how it's going to sound.
What's the name of the piece?
It's called Ife.
Ife from Philip Glass, to be performed in Luxembourg on January 17th with the Luxembourg Philharmonic Orchestra. Angelique Kidjo will be closer to home, headlining at Town Hall on February 15th in support of the new record called Eve, which is out later this month. And on Thursday, we will continue our conversation at Barnes & Noble at Union Square. Join us then. The memoir is called Spirit Rising, My Life, My Music. Angelique Kidjo, great to see you again.
It's always a pleasure to be with you, John.
To come here at Soundcheck, we leave matters of copyright up to the professionals. We'll get a visit from the copycat next. They say there are 8 million stories in the Naked City. This is one of them. Sure, it's a crime story, but this one's kind of complicated. Intellectual property. That's right, baby. Copyright. Trademarks. What happens when the public domain gets a little too public? To explain it, you need someone who knows the law. To some, he's a mild-mannered attorney. But to us, he's the copycat. The copycat is otherwise known as intellectual property attorney Jonathan Reichman from the firm Kenyon & Kenyon LLP. John, welcome back to Soundcheck.
Thank you, John.
So we just had to talk to you today about rapper Rick Ross, who, as you know, is suing the band LMFAO over a line in their hit song Party Rock Anthem. They have that lyric, "Every day I'm shufflin'." And Rick Ross claims that rips off his song Hustlin', where he famously says, "Every day I'm hustlin'." Now, it occurs to me this could be the shortest segment in Soundcheck history if your answer to this question is a simple no. But does Rick Ross have a legal leg to stand on?
Well, I think potentially he has a claim. How much remedy or relief he can get out of it is a very open question, and I have some serious doubts about it.
All right. Well, let's, for folks who haven't heard these two back-to-back, let's give you a chance to listen to what we're talking about. First, the Rick Ross song, Hustlin', and then the LMFAO song called Party Rock Anthem.
The MIA, this is where we hustle. Every day I'm hustling, 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 every day I'm, every day I'm, every day I'm hustling. Who you suckers think you're tripping with? Yes, I'm the boss. 745, white on white, that's Rick Ross.
We gon' make you lose your mind. We just wanna see you.
Every day I'm shuffling.
Okay, so there's LMFAO with their party rock anthem, and before that, Rick Ross's song Hustlin'. So, John, I would say when I first heard Party Rock Anthem, I thought that was a clear allusion to the Rick Ross song. Rick Ross is saying it's a clear ripoff.
That's right. And I think it is an obvious allusion. I think because the Rick Ross line has become so popular, I think LMFAO wanted to incorporate it. The question is whether their doing so rises to the level of fair use or whether it's simply misappropriation. And you have to start with several basic points here. The first point is that the copyright law is very clear that short phrases in and of themselves are not copyrightable. They're right in the public domain. And it's obvious to me, I read the court papers, and it's obvious to me that Rick Ross's lawyers are aware of that. So what they've done is that they've built their infringement claim based around a combination of elements. They're saying that LMFAO didn't simply take that line, that phrase. They also took the beat and the underlying music. So the question is whether that combination of elements gives rise to a claim that wouldn't be there based upon the phrase alone. And I think even that's thin.
Yeah. And could it also be said on LMFAO's behalf that it's not either a ripoff or even an allusion, but a parody? Because the song, especially when you watch the video, is clearly kind of a parody of all these high-living, high-rolling sort of lifestyle videos.
Yeah, I think they could make that argument. It is, the question is the parody so diffuse and broad and not really focused on the Rick Ross song that a court might say, well, that's too general. You know, there's got to be more pointedness to the parody.
Right. But the idea that you can copyright a line from a song, that we know that that's not something you can do. There was, remember that band Frankie Goes to Hollywood back in the 80s? They had that hit song Relax.
Relax, don't you rest when you want to go to rest.
They tried, you know, people started printing up T-shirts with Relax, or even Frankie Says Relax. And the band tried to sue, and they couldn't get any satisfaction, because how do you copyright a word?
That's right. You know, and I was also wondering whether Rick Ross might have been better served to assert some type of a trademark claim. In other words, that the phrase, every day I'm hustling, has become sort of a slogan, a catchphrase for him that takes it out of copyright and moves it to a different area of intellectual property law.
But then wouldn't he have had to file a trademark claim or register a trademark or service mark for that phrase?
He wouldn't have to register it. He could claim just based on UCA's rights, but even that claim would have some uphill battles because the law is very clear that if you're using somebody else's trademark in the context of like a song or a book or some type of work of expression, you have a lot of latitude, a lot of leeway there. So it seems like whether he's going in the copyright direction or in the trademark direction, he's going to be facing some real limitations.
And why do you think Rick Ross would wait so long to file this suit? I mean, the song came out early in 2011. I think we know why he's filing the suit. I mean, the thing has sold like 7 or 8 million digital copies. There's a lot of money there.
Yeah, I think I was thinking about that, and there could be a couple of things going on. One is it's possible that he's been in dialogue with LMFAO trying to resolve this and settle it informally, and it just they reached a point where the negotiations weren't going anywhere. Mm. Another thing is one of the claims in the lawsuit is against Kia Motors, the car company, because the Every Day I'm Shufflin' song and the phrase from, the Every Day I'm Shufflin' phrase and the Party Rock Anthem song has been incorporated into a commercial.
Yeah, now, quite prominently as well, yeah.
Yeah, if merchandising it by LMFAO is a relatively recent development, that could have ratcheted up the stakes that could have induced Rick Ross to bring suit now.
Yeah, and how does Kia get on the hook here? I mean, as far as they know, I'm sure whatever contract they signed with LMFAO must have indemnified them and said, you know, it's an original work and you're blameless and harmless or whatever that language is.
Sure, that doesn't immunize them from a claim by Rick Ross, because if it's an act of infringement, then no matter who brought it to them, they're technically engaging in infringement. However, as you point out, Kia can then turn around and go back to LMFAO and say, under this contract, you have this obligation to indemnify us,
right.
So you know you have to do this now.
All right. We're talking with the copycat, Jonathan Reichman from the firm of Kenyon & Kenyon LLP. Whenever we have copyright questions, we go to John. And the timing here is so ironic and interesting, John, because just a couple of days ago, Rick Ross won a lawsuit in which he was being sued by this drug kingpin named Freeway Rick Ross, who claimed that the rapper had stolen his name and kind of played on his identity. So Rick Ross, the rapper, has just won a First Amendment suit, and now here he is filing one, sort of.
I know, although that's not surprising, especially these days, where you have internet companies who are both owners of intellectual property and users of others. It's very common now for one company to be playing kind of both sides of the fence.
So it's the wild, wild west out there.
Absolutely.
Jonathan Reichman, the copycat, with us on Soundcheck today. John, thanks very much. Happy New Year to you.
My pleasure. Same to you, John. Take care.
As you probably have heard, Phil Everly of the Everly Brothers passed away last week, just shy of his 75th birthday. Tomorrow on Soundcheck, we'll hear about the legacy of the Everly Brothers and look at some of the contemporary artists that were influenced by them. Plus, singer-songwriter Jordan Lee has been quietly releasing music on the internet and on cassette under the name Mutual Benefit, but his latest album, called Love's Crushing Diamond, earned rave reviews at the end of 2013, and that band will play live in the studio tomorrow on Soundcheck. For now, we'll leave you with a little bit from the Everly Brothers. And devoted to you.
Devoted to you. I'll never hurt you. I'll never lie. I'll never be untrue. I'll never give you reason to cry. I'd be unhappy if you were blue. My love will grow like a river, it will flow. It can't die because I'm so devoted to you.
Soundcheck is a production of WNYC. Irene Trudell leads our engineering team with Paul Schneider, Bill O'Neill, and Jason Isaac. The show is produced by Katie Bishop, Dan O'Donnell, and Mike Katziff with Amy Pearl. Our executive producer is Joel Meyer. I'm John Schaefer. This is Soundcheck.
I'd be unhappy.